content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue. Today's first article is titled, The History of Earth Day, From Radical Roots to Elementary School Classrooms. This story is published as a part of Covering Climate Now, a global journalism collaboration strengthening coverage of the climate story. If you ask Adam Rome, Earth Day isn't as punk as it used to be. Earth Day is so tame nowadays, says Rome, the author of The Genius of Earth Day, How a 1970 Teach-In Unexpectedly Made the First Green Generation. For adults, it's often a trade show where you can see the latest green stuff, and for kids, it's often a day with some corporate-sponsored lesson about how you can do about what you can do individually to save the planet. But the first Earth Day in 1970, Rome says, was an intense day of protest and activism for the 20 million people who participated. It was a day to ask soul-searching questions about why we had environmental problems, Rome says. It's not just Rome who sees a short-sightedness in the way we mark Earth Day today. For Elizabeth Yimpierre, a Puerto Rican attorney and the executive director of Brooklyn-based community organization UpRose, Earth Day is merely one marker in a long global history of environmental injustice. When you talk about Earth Day, for us, it's not 50 years, it's 500 years of extraction. It's 500 years since slavery, since colonialism, she says. And in those 500 years, our communities have managed to survive all of it. Now we are faced with the consequences of those 500 years. For better or worse, Earth Day is the closest that the modern environmental movement has to a birthday, a time to celebrate milestones, to look back and plot a way forward. And as Earth Day has morphed since its inception, this year promises to be radically different. The surge of energy from youth activism over the past few years has been impeded by the coronavirus and bans on in-person gatherings. Organizers are hoping that the energy of the original Earth Day can take hold with a new generation grappling with a rapidly changing world. A green revolution. Environmental protections in the United States essentially did not exist 50 years ago. Before the 1970s, industries of all types were allowed to pollute with little to no oversight, and Americans were largely in the dark about the impact air and water pollution could have on their health. Prior to the first Earth Day, people across the country were disturbed by a 1969 oil spill in California, and their environmental consciousness was beginning to be raised, thanks in part to Rachel Carson's seminal 1962 book, Silent Spring. Then, in 1970, Senator Gaylord Nelson, a Democrat from Wisconsin, recruited grassroots organizers across the country to coordinate events on a single day, April 22nd, to educate the public on environmental issues. The scale of the organizing effort involved in the first Earth Day was massive, but Earth Day didn't happen in a vacuum. The year 1970 came after a tumultuous decade of social upheaval and change, with the Vietnam War mobilizing thousands of young people to speak out, second-wave feminism bringing women out of the home and into the workforce, and the civil rights movement providing a model for what a nationwide environmental organizing effort could look like. The original founders of Earth Day literally borrowed pages from the then-happening civil rights movement to engage in righteous self-disobedience, righteous group mass action, to have humanity look at environmental degradation and the degradation of lives of individuals. Aaron Mayer, the Sierra Club's first black president, told the New Republic in 2017. The result was a resounding success. environmental safeguards that we consider basic today, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Clean Air and Water Acts, the Endangered Species Act, all came about following the massive impact of the early 1970s movements. According to Rome, Earth Day also gave rise to the formation of robust eco-infrastructure around protecting the environment. Activists involved in the early movement went on to create new careers to protect the changes they'd made and continue pushing for more, as environmental lawyers, lobbyists, nonprofit leaders, professors. Newspapers hired reporters to write about environmental issues. Green groups like the Sierra Club, now a household name, beefed up membership and bulked up their activism, while many others were born on the day's aftermath. For a moment in the 1970s, the future looked bright, inclusive, and green. Going mainstream. When young Pierre joined UpRose in 1996, she says she considered herself a social justice activist, and she had no history of working on environmental issues. But as a young person in the community began telling her their concerns, she recognized common fights. "They started talking to me about asthma, about truck traffic, about paint," she remembers. "It became clear that if we couldn't breathe, we couldn't fight against bad policing." It may seem now as though community-based organizations like UpRose, which started organizing around climate justice in the early 2000s, would be the natural heirs to the grassroots organizers behind the early Earth Day movement. But throughout the 90s, the 2000s, many small organizations felt that the mainstream green conversation, which focused on sustainability, enacting bipartisan climate policy, and promoting climate science, left out the needs of justice activists. Rome attributes much of this disconnect to the original Earth Day movement's success. After agreeing to make changes to their business models to preserve the environment, companies began to recognize the financial cost of environmental regulations and push to have them relaxed. Ronald Reagan unleashed a wave of pro-business activity in the Republican Party, and the GOP took up the mantle of deregulation. The eco-infrastructure set up in the wake of the Earth Day mobilized to save what their movement had created. With partisan divisiveness escalating, grassroots movements, including movements helmed by people of color, were left by the wayside as more nationally oriented white, middle-class environmental movement took hold. The big green groups are always happy to have the help of somebody who's not an environmentalist, Rome explains. A labor union wants to help them, great, but they're not on the street picketing when laborers go on strike. "We think that the environmental movement is sort of lefty, but a lot of environmental organizations are not self-identified as part of a broader progressive movement." Jean-Pierre says that big green groups, which have carried the national conversation, run the policy agenda and received much of the green funding since Earth Day. Have not only ignored activists of color, but exploited them. "The big greens always knew who we were because we got into fights about the distribution of resources, the distribution of power, how the big greens would sort of heavy foot into our communities and undermine the work that we were doing, how they would supplant not only our leadership, but make it impossible for us to move the dial," she says. "The culture of these institutions has been an extractive culture." What's next for Earth Day? In late March, representatives from a coalition of grassroots green organizations held a press call to explain how the coronavirus crisis was changing their original plans for massive Earth Day demonstrations. Naina Agrawal-Hardin, a 17-year-old activist with the Sunrise Movement, sounded upbeat even as she acknowledged the huge changes taking hold. The pandemic is a disaster, Agrawal Haldane says, but is also a movement of opportunity and of hope of rebuilding our society into one that works for all people. She emphasized the movement's demands for a short-term COVID response, which will prioritize people over profits, part of a long-term plan to deliver a just and livable future for my generation. Other youth climate activists, like Zero Hour's Jamie Morgolin, have pointed out that the rapid global response to this health crisis shows that a similar mobilization is possible to address the climate emergency, and they're trying to lead the way. In 2019, 4 million people around the world took to the streets during 1 week in September as part of the largest ever climate mobilization. A generation increasingly anxious and outraged about climate change helped persuade Americans that preserving the environment was inextricably linked to social, political, and environmental justice, and that we don't have a lot of time to figure out what to do about it. Rome sees this kind of movement as returning to the spirit of the original Earth Day. Now it's often the local community groups that have the overwhelming focus on health, says and health and justice, he says. They live with the burden directly. They're the ones getting asthma. They're the ones getting cancer. In 1970, that was a major focus of a lot of Earth Day organizing, period. The coronavirus has cut millions of Americans off from healthcare, sources of income, community connection, all key elements that have traditionally enabled organizing to thrive. It's a daunting moment for climate activists to overcome, but the pandemic, Jean-Pierre says, is a harbinger of a future marked by disastrous extreme weather events, and it's proof that we need to work toward environmental justice and preparedness right now. What do we do if a climate disrupts governance? Jean-Pierre asks. If climate disrupts all of our systems, how do we survive? How do we reclaim the traditions that were taught to us so that we can create local, livable economies, so that we can survive the impacts of what's coming? The next article is titled, The Jewish Teens Who Fought Back Against Hitler. Sherry Rosenblum learned about the Holocaust the same way most kids do. She was taught about the atrocities of Nazi death camps and shown gruesome images of skeletal Jewish survivors and massacred bodies. I had no historical context for it, she told Teen Vogue. It was like watching a horror movie. I really did not understand it. It was the totally wrong way to be introduced to it. The history lesson that Rosenblum was taught as a fifth grader at Jewish summer camp reinforced the idea that Jews simply went like sheep to the slaughter, she said. Now she's dedicated to telling a different and often overlooked part of this story. Sherry works at the Jewish Partisan Educational Foundation, or JPEF, a San Francisco-based nonprofit focused on teaching students about the thousands of Jews who fought back against Hitler's plan to exterminate them. During World War II, as many as 30,000 Jewish people joined resistance groups throughout Europe. Known as partisans, they formed their own combat units and also joined non-Jewish partisan armies to battle Hitler's forces. They attacked German troops, blew up trains and bridges, sabotaged infrastructure like power plants and factories, and did everything they could to stop the Nazis. They were just a small portion of a larger partisan movement across the continent, but they inflicted significantly more damage than their counterparts, according to JPEF. Many of them were teenagers. Despite being confined to segregated ghettos across Europe, some Jews armed themselves and attacked Nazis, most famously in the 1943 Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Those who escaped ghettos and concentration camps often fled to the forests, determined to survive and, in many cases, resist. Etta Robel, a 20-year-old Jewish girl, lived with her family in Lukow, Poland, when the Germans invaded in 1939. Her father was part of the Polish underground, and he taught her how to fight back too. He instructed me to help the underground resistance and constantly encouraged me, she later told JPEF, adding that he told her, I order you to survive. And that's what I did. Roble falsified papers to help people evade Nazi terror, according to the account she provided to JPEF. She was caught and imprisoned, but later escaped. At one point, she worked in a restaurant, and Germans coming in to eat would hang up their belts and coats, and she started stealing their guns. At another cleaning job, she would spy for information, sharing what she found about military plans and roundups. Later, she says, she escaped into the nearby woods and helped form an all-Jewish partisan unit. There, she refused to do traditional women's work. Instead, she would wear a cross and pretend to be a Polish Christian, finding small groups of Jews who were hiding and bring them back to her unit's makeshift hideout in the woods. Roble says she helped her partisan group steal food and other needed supplies and put mines in the road to slow German troops. She told JPEF that she would make a clicking sound like insects, using it as a secret code with other partisans for safety. At one point, she got shot, but the group's doctor was busy, so she took the bullet out of her own leg with a knife. It's very important to know, you know, they stereotype. The Jews go like sheep. It's not true. They never did, Roble told JPEF. Thousands of years ago, they didn't, and they don't do it now. To Roble, fighting back wasn't just about striking blows to German forces. It was primarily about saving other Jewish people and surviving hellish conditions. Every day was a struggle, she said. We saved about 100 people, she said. This was my thing to do, because I think that's the most important. That's the biggest resistance that we could have done to the Germans, is to survive. Other Jewish partisans felt the same way. The most famous example is the Bielski brothers and their group of partisans. Though they sought out and killed Nazi collaborators, these Jewish partisans in Belarus focused on saving their people from certain death. At its peak, their group contained more than 1,200 people hiding from the Nazis, mostly women and children and the elderly. In Belgium, Jews and non-Jews formed the Committee for the Defense of the Jews, primarily to hide thousands of Jewish children from the Nazis. But they also successfully derailed a train headed for Auschwitz death camp and rescued the hundreds of people on board. As JPEF explains in their study guide, Jewish partisans saved thousands of Jewish lives, in some cases literally breaking Jews out of the confines of well-guarded ghettos, and in at least one situation, digging a tunnel to free 250 people from a ghetto. Most partisans during World War II, Jewish or otherwise, were men. But Roble was far from the only inspiring woman among them. Brenda Senders joined a 1,600-person partisan unit in eastern Poland when she was 17, according to the JPEF. If I was going to die, I wanted to die with a gun in my hand, fighting my enemy, she told the foundation, which interviewed dozens of former partisans. I wanted revenge. Some partisans were even younger. In France, 12-year-old Bernard Musmad helped the Jewish resistance by working as a courier, smuggling documents and false IDs. At age 13, he joined partisan military action against the Nazis, according to JPEF. When Nazis started exterminating Jews in Vilna, Lithuania, young activists led the resistance. In a now famous ghetto manifesto read to a Jewish youth group, a 23-year-old Abba Kovner declared, "They shall not take us like sheep to the slaughter. It is true that we are weak and defenseless, but resistance is the only reply to the enemy. It is better to fall as free fighters than to live by the grace of the murderers. Resist to that last breath." Vitka Kepner was 19 when Kovner made his declaration. Along with Kovner and others, she helped form the United Partisans organization, and she carried out its first sabotage, bombing a nearby Nazi train line. Their group armed themselves by bringing weapons into the Vilna ghetto through the sewer system, and when they later needed to bring the guns out, they hid them in coffins, she told JPEF. Kempner eventually helped start an all-Jewish partisan group called the Avengers, which blew up a power plant, among other things. Once she snuck back into Vilna to bomb the Nazis, electrical transformers, and water supply. "After a few hours, we heard explosions, and the city fell into darkness," she recounted to JPEF. "There was great joy, and it had an impact on the Germans, who understood that the partisans had reached all the way into Vilna. They didn't know that a few Jewish boys and girls did that." These are the kinds of stories that the JPEF is working to preserve and spread. Founded in 2000, the organization has interviewed dozens of former Jewish partisans about their experiences during the Holocaust. They've developed curricula that 25,000 teachers, mostly in North America, use in their classrooms every year, Sherry Rosenblum said. The foundation also collaborates with 45 Holocaust remembrance organizations worldwide, including museums. They estimate that their work reaches more than 1 million young people a year, namely middle and high school students. The JPEF is in the process of translating their material into more languages. They offer in-person teaching trainings and recently wrapped up programs in Alabama, New York, and Poland. Arizona and New Jersey are next, Rosenblum said. Of all the content produced by the foundation, one of the most popular is a photo exhibit featuring pictures taken by Faye Schulman. When Schulman was 22, Germans started killing Jews in her ghetto of Lenin, Poland. She escaped and joined a nearby partisan unit, serving as her group's nurse and using her camera to document the war. "I want people to know that there was resistance," Schulman told JPEF. "I was a photographer. I have pictures. I have proof." Rosenblum told Teen Vogue that sharing the photos and stories with Jewish students is invaluable. Students will say, "I always pictured the Jews as being victims. Learning about this as a young Jew makes me feel proud to be Jewish," she said. There are lessons for non-Jewish students too, of course. Jewish partisans told JPEF that they hoped future generations would take three main things from their examples. Young people can make a difference. Stand up to oppression and discrimination early, before it's too late, and never give up. Rosenblum hopes that students who learn about the Jewish partisans will think about how these lessons can apply to their own lives and that it inspires them to take action. The Jewish groups going to detention camps and speaking out now, they're a perfect example of what we're trying to impart to kids, Rosenblum said. This is what people should be doing. And there are two photos here with this article, with four, what looks like Jewish youth, one woman and three men. And there's a second photo, and the caption reads, Partisan Faye Shulman poses with a rifle. And this photo is from the Jewish Partisan Educational Foundation, and it's titled Faye Shulman, A Partisan's Memoir. And since we just have a few minutes left, related to the first article from today, there's another Teen Vogue article that's titled 10 Simple Things to Do to Celebrate Earth Day. So I'll touch on these 10 things here, which I know Earth Day has passed, but you can still do these things because climate change is still a very real thing. Number one, plant something. Trees not only cool things down, collectively, they can help decrease a city's temperature by up to 10 degrees, but they also clean the air and give off more oxygen, among a ton of other benefits. Ride your bike. Find transportation alternatives that help reduce your carbon footprint, but get you moving. Let your voice be heard. Feeling passionate about certain environmental causes or pieces of legislation? Check out some of the excellent youth climate activist organizations out there like Sunrise Movement, Zero Hour, Extinction Rebellion Youth, and Fridays for Future. Tune in to Earth Day Live. With in-person protests canceled because of COVID-19, Earth Day events are moving online. Buy reusable bags. It's been estimated that Americans use 100 billion plastic bags a year, and just the production alone for those requires about 12 million barrels of oil. Not to mention, they take up a lot of space in landfills and cause major problems for marine wildlife. So instead, buy some super cute reusable bags that you can use when you go to the grocery store. Use a refillable water bottle. Get produce from a local farmer's market. Shop smart for clothes, places like ThredUp, to go see if you can buy reused clothes. Unsubscribe to catalogs. The fact that a million trees are cut down each year to produce junk mail includes catalogs. Spend time outside. Sometimes we can be so caught up in what's happening on Instagram or keeping up with the Kardashians that we forget how much fun it is to be outside. Earth Day is just a reminder of how beautiful and awesome our planet is. Take advantage of it. If you have a backyard, spend some time in the afternoon outdoors reading, having lunch, or just taking in a deep breath of the fresh air. Okay, well, now we have run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. My name is Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.